Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Well, good evening and welcome on this stormy May night, and it certainly is a stormy night. To the Kudzu Band, this is Tim Shiflett. You might have noticed right off that I ain't David. But hey, Catherine is here. Good evening, Catherine.
Hello, welcome from Atlanta.
And we have a big-time sit-in for David tonight, folks from Peanut Politics, the Rural Georgia blog, Mr. Keith McCants. Good evening, Keith. How are you?
Hey, Tim. How y'all doing today?
We are doing quite well. By the way, I did want to do a shout-out to all the folks that took part in our Jefferson Jackson Day dinner last night here in Somerville, featuring former Governor Barnes and our U.S. Senate candidate R.J. Hadley. We had a great crowd. People from all over the state was there, people from labor, people from surrounding counties. We had a packed house. We even had a Republican spy in the room, folks, videotaping the whole thing. I hope they got my good profile side. But anyway, we'd like to thank everyone for making it a very successful night, and we certainly hope we're going to have a very successful year. Speaking of successful, last Sunday night, we had Jason Carter on the show. Catherine, big night for Jason Tuesday night.
Big night for Jason Carter. Big night, and good next day, too, because he, as you may have heard, he won by... I think it was 65%. Got 65% of the vote. And the following day, his opponent in the primary asked to have his name removed from the ballot. So it looks like Jason's in for the next session. So that's very good news. He won't have to launch a big campaign for the general.
Now, will there be an independent, the Libertarian candidate on the ballot come July or come November rather?
I don't think there's any other candidates on the air on the ballot. I don't know if there's an independent or there may be, but
yeah,
there's not another Democrat or another Republican.
Yeah, he had an independent candidate in the race and he had a Libertarian. Both of those got under 10%. And I was wondering maybe if they had qualified for November. Now Keith, I blog on a rather conservative out-of-state blog.
Right.
A lot of those conservatives have mentioned to me that they think that Jason Carter, you know, we don't want to ever get ahead of ourselves, but they think that he's the kind of candidate with the kind of family background and all that could really go a long way in Georgia politics. If someday he were to run a statewide race, how would he play in rural Georgia?
He'll play really well down here. The only question about that is, you know, is on his father. You know, down my way, Jimmy Carter is kind of big. He's still kind of big down this way. And and he, you know, he has a really good shot of doing really, really well down here. He's got the Carter name. From what I understand, he's anti-abortion. What somebody told me, I heard he was anti-abortion. Those kind of issues like that, they resonate down here, you know. And he has a shot, but it depends how he does in the Senate, you know, how he does with things like that. Because down here, you know, because down here, you know, people, they pay attention to that, you know, your voting record and things like that. You know, you vote wrong one way, then you finish.
Yeah, Catherine, is he the kind of candidate you look at and you think he has an aura about him? Like he really could go a long way in politics. Again, not getting ahead of ourselves.
I do think that. I think he's very committed to sort of the general values of the Democratic Party, as well as being very interested in public service. And he's very, have you ever met him?
I have met him, yes.
He's very personable and very authentic. I mean, you really feel when you're talking to him, he's really talking to you. He's not looking past you to see who's behind you that he really needs to talk to, like some of the politicians that we all, you know, come in contact with. And his family has instilled in him a true belief in the importance of public service, and I think that resonates well with people, even if you may not agree with everything that his entire agenda. I think that he is very committed to Georgia. And of course he's done all this work with Democrats' work, and he served in the Peace Corps. So I think he has a very good understanding of the responsibilities of public service, as well as just the general responsibilities of being a citizen of this country. So I think we're all optimistic that maybe not Jason Carter himself, but people like Jason Carter will be coming up in the ranks of the Democratic Party in Georgia, and that they are our bench for the future. And if he's an indication of what there is out there to offer, I think we're in really good shape. I'm very optimistic about Jason and people like him. The people that he had a great group of people working on his campaign. I'm really sorry I didn't go to the returns party because his grandfather and his grandmother were there.
Yeah, and, I saw their picture.
I guess it was a lot of fun. A couple of my friends were there, and they were all having a really good time, and everyone was very, very pleased with the excellent results of that election. So I also think he's interested in helping the Democratic Party become a stronger party in this state. So I think that, you know, we have a lot to look forward to, and but we can't, I mean, he is will be a freshman senator, so we can't put too much pressure on him quite yet, right?
Right. But Jason, if you're listening, buddy, we do offer our heartfelt congratulations, and we wanted to let you know that our door on the kudzu vine is open to you at any time. Now, I did want to slip in right here with an announcement that in a few minutes, we are expecting a guest to call in. General David Poitras, candidate for governor of Georgia, is supposed to call in and share a few thoughts on the campaign and some other issues tonight. And he should be with us in a few minutes. But while we have time, I want to turn to some other stuff. And one thing I want to turn to is something that you would know about, Keith. And that's this 8th Congressional District race. Congressman Marshall's had a couple of close calls. And his race was rated earlier this year as either leans Democrat or safe Democratic. Suddenly, Austin Scott threw us all a curve, dropped out of the governor's race. We heard all kind of rumors that maybe Johnny Isaacson had talked him into doing this or whatever, and he has now entered the 8th District Congressional race. On the ground down there, how does this race look to you?
The way it looks right now, Marshall could be in a real dog fight down here in the 8th District because, you know, judging by history of Marshall, the midterms are usually very low turnout for Marshall. You know, in 51-49, if you remember Matt Collins from 2006, 2008 he beat Rick Goddard 57-42%. it's possible Austin Scott can defeat Jim Marshall. But the way things look right now, I just don't see it. And one main reason is the health care vote. He voted no against the health care. Had he voted yes for the health care reform bill, Marshall would be in big trouble. Really big trouble right now.
Now, you had mentioned before we went on the air a coalition of voters that consistently shows up and votes for Congressman Marshall. Who is this coalition? What groups are they made of?
Well, number one, he has a lot of Republican support. Then he has the black vote, the Macon Bibb County vote, the more liberal vote. Then he has a good number of independents as well, and moderate to conservative Democrats. So he got that coalition split with him. The only way I can see Austin Scott beating Jim Marshall this year is if he can take away those Republicans that have been voting for Jim Marshall since 2002, 2004. If he manages, if he can do that, he has a shot. But that coalition is the main reason why Jim Marshall always he always be reelected down there. Although the district leans Republican plus 10, plus 12, last time I checked. But the way I look at it, the 8th district is what I call the graveyard for Republicans. You know, they always have these high hopes. They have these high hopes going in there. I see Jim Marshall, that thing, you know, he's standing at the finish line with hands raised as victorious. So that's the graveyard, what I call the Republicans, you know. And also Scott, you know, he's very appealing. You know, he's young, he's energetic, he has a good message, you know. But as of right now, unless Jim Marshall does something really, really, really stupid or outrageous, he's going to get reelected. I say right now, 56-44, that's what I call it.
56-44. Catherine, we've talked about this race. What do you think?
Well, I was just wondering, I haven't looked at the disclosures as far as money. Does Austin Scott have any money?
Last I checked, he had about a little over $300,000.
And how about Jim Marshall?
He has around a little over $800,000.
Oh, so I mean, if it gets dicey, he and Jim Marshall can probably raise more money if he needs to.
Right.
I mean, if polling indicates that he's in trouble, he should be able to get money from the D-Trip and from, you know, around the country as well as from Georgia. I was just wondering about that because that's often a big indicator is, you know, who's got the most money. Though, you know, it doesn't always work that way, as we know, with Governor Barnes in 2000.
Keith, if the Republicans did talk Austin Scott into running this race and getting out of the governor's race, were they more interested in clearing the field a little bit in the governor's race, or were they more interested in running somebody against Marshall?
The way I look at it, they were more interested in avoiding a primary between Kasich Cagle and Austin Scott. That's how I look at it.
You thought Austin Scott was going to run for lieutenant governor?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's an interesting twist. I hadn't thought about
that. Would have been an interesting race, too, wouldn't it?
It would have, you know. And, you know, and right now, Carol Porter, you know, she's going to be the nominee. And the way, I mean, I told a couple of my Republican friends that they would have been better off had Austin Scott ran against Kasich Cagle and knocking off Kasich Cagle and keeping that seat in control of the GOP. But at where it stands right now, Carol Porter has a really, really excellent chance of knocking off Kasich Cagle. I mean, he's not well-liked by the base, and, you know, I'm going to say this one more time. They did that race. The reason why they persuaded Austin Scott he ran against Jim Marshall, he had to avoid a primary battle between Casey Cagle and Austin Scott. They just tried to want to avoid that battle. It wasn't because Jim Marshall. It wasn't because of the governor's race. It was because of that very reason right there.
Tim,
we have a caller.
We have a caller from the 404. I'm gonna put them on.
Okay. General Portress, is that you, sir?
Hold on. Why is it? Okay. There. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine.
Well, thank you, Catherine. How are you?
Good.
General Portress, good evening.
Good
General,
evening.
How are you doing?
I'm well. Tim, hope
this
you guys
is,
are.
This is Tim, and you've already talked to Catherine, and Keith McCants is on with us tonight, subbing for David.
Yeah, hey, Keith, how are you?
Hey, David, how you doing today?
I'm well.
Okay, we're going to turn it over in just a minute to Catherine and Keith to ask you a few questions about the governor's race, but before we do that, I wanted to talk about something else with you. On February 2nd, you showed TV viewers a pledge
right.
that you had signed concerning unemployment, shall we say. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, that was in the, and that has become a central part of my campaign. In a debate over in Athens, which was on television, the question came up, what would you as governor do about unemployment? And a good bit of the discussion was of a very strategic, almost theoretical nature. And when it came my turn, I said, look, I mean, these are good ideas, but what are you going to do for the guy who's unemployed today, who's looking for a job right now? I've got some ideas, and in addition to that, I'm prepared to share the burden and walk the walk, not just talk the talk. And my pledge is that until we bring unemployment in Georgia below 7%, I'm not going to draw a paycheck as governor. It's now 10.6. We think we've got to get at least 160,000 jobs to reach that. But I think it's important that the people of Georgia know that the governor is committed to them and not just wants to get in office to take it easy and make himself rich.
And how have the other Democratic candidates responded to you doing that?
Nobody has picked up on it. I didn't challenge anybody to do it. It was just something that I wanted to do as a statement of my personal commitment, and nobody else has responded.
I see. And what about on the Republican side? Has anyone said anything similar to that you know of?
Not a chance, no.
I had to ask. I certainly did.
No.
Okay, General, at this time, we're going to throw it to Catherine and then to Keith for some questions about the governor's race. Catherine.
Well, first of all, General, thank you so much for being on here. We know that Sunday nights are often reserved for family, and we really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us tonight. Our listeners always appreciate candidates coming on and talking with us. How is the race going? What's happening? What are you working on right now?
Well, it's the race is shaping up pretty much as we have expected. We had two late entries, two additional Democratic candidates qualified. It doesn't fundamentally change the dynamics. I think it's perfectly clear that our Democratic primary will go to a runoff. We feel very confident that it will be myself and former Governor Barnes in the runoff, and I believe I'll win the runoff. We feel quite good about the general election. Going back to the 90s when I was elected labor commissioner, I have always been able to attract swing voters and indeed a few moderate Republicans who will cross over primarily on my military connection and also just because I've got a solid record of fiscal conservatism as far as running state government is concerned.
And who do you want to run against in the general?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not ducking it. I really just don't know. I mean, clearly they will go to a runoff as well, and the wisdom abroad in the land is that it'll be Commissioner Oxendine with someone else in a runoff. But who that other person will be, I think, is very problematic. I think their race is very fluid.
I agree. It looks to me, I mean, we talk about this a lot, it looks like it's going to be Oxendine and either, my general feeling is it's going to either be Handel or Eric Johnson. I think Nathan Deal is sort of fizzling on the, withering on the vine, as they say.
I know Johnson, Eric has been advertising heavily around South Georgia. We see his ads. People talk about his ads. I think he is working that rural vote, Keith, pretty hard, and particularly over around coastal Georgia.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to Keith, and if we have time, maybe we can come back and talk some more about it.
Okay. Thanks, Kat.
Hey, Gerald, how you doing today?
I'm well. We've been down in your part of the woods lately.
Yes. How is your campaign being received in rural Georgia so far?
Very well. We have been on the air 2 weeks. 2 weeks and 2 days at this point in Georgia, outside of Atlanta. We bought a little bit of Atlanta time, but most of it has been the other markets, and it's been generally quite well received. We went up the day before Governor Barnes went up. Our ad has been very well received. We've gotten a lot of good feedback. We started, frankly, getting money almost the day it went up. People were spontaneously calling in or going up on the Internet. So we think we're getting good traction out in the state. I think there are a tremendous number of Democratic votes out there. I think anybody who writes off rural Georgia is making a tremendous mistake.
I agree. That's the problem right there with the Democratic Party for the past few years. They always write off rural Georgia. Just focus on the cities and the suburbs. And I've been saying for a long time, you know, they got to expand their base into rural Georgia. Chance of winning in the statewide. Let me ask you another question here. What's your plan for education? The GOP, they've been cutting like crazy education here.
Yeah, they're talking. When you boil it down, they're talking vouchers, which in my opinion is essentially an abdication of the state's responsibility for public education. It would be a disaster. We would wind up with a rich, educated class and a uneducated, less well-off class, and that's just horrible. We can't do that. My plan is, first I'll say, Keith, I'm the only candidate with a published plan. It's on my website. It's 2 pages. It's very simple, straightforward. There are two principal keys to it. One is, stop blaming teachers.
I agree.
For the last 12 years, the mantra has been, well, blame it on the teachers. It's all their fault. If we just, if the state will just regulate them hard enough and regiment their lives tightly enough, they'll behave and everything will be all right. That's just unfair. It's wrong, and it hasn't worked. These are professional people. We should acknowledge and treat them as professionals. And what I mean by that is give them the latitude to be creative in the classroom, to really be excited about what they're doing, and get kids excited and keep kids excited. The second piece is we as a state should make a full-up commitment as a state to the latest and the best in educational technology that we can put in the hands of our teachers. A number of counties have already done that, but as a state, we have not stepped up to that. This is more than just computers and smart boards. It's really about the software, what they call the learningware. That's where the real creativity is, the real innovations. That's the way education is going around the globe, and we must recognize that. If we don't, we're shortchanging the kids, and we're shortchanging the future of the state of Georgia.
I agree. Catherine?
Tim, did you have any questions?
I had a couple of more I wanted to jump in there with. I did have one other question about your 7% idea, General. It would seem that a pledge like this is very forthright and a good thing. Why do you think none of the other candidates would eagerly sign on to something like this?
I don't know, Tim. I'll have to let them speak for themselves. I think, and let me put it in a little bit more context. But I think the crowd that we have got down there now has been so self-interested. They have engaged in so much self-dealing, so much personal enrichment at the taxpayer's expense, that we need a governor who will restore trust in public office. And that's the context, and one of the pieces of the context in which I made that commitment. I just think people are they're mad with politicians. They don't think politicians are on their side, and I want to change that. At least as far as David Poitras is concerned, I'm on their side, and I'm going to fix this thing. I'm going to get unemployment below 7%. I did it in the 90s when I was labor commissioner. We had a terrible recession then, if anybody remembers. And when I when I became revenue commissioner in 92, I kicked in job training programs, job placement programs, youth motivational programs, and we turned this state around and we got it going. And the latter part of the 90s was one of the most prosperous times we have ever seen.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, changing gears a little bit. Of course, you're probably asked all the time about differences between you and the Republicans and how you're going to win the race in November and this and that and the other. And it's pretty easy to see, of course, the differences in Democrats and Republicans. But what is going to decide the race just amongst the Democrats in the Democratic primary? What's going to decide that race?
I think it's going to come down to electability. I really do. I think people who vote in primaries tend to be knowledgeable, people who are politically interested and who genuinely follow politics. And I think we have been in the wilderness for eight years. And if we do not win back the governor's office this year, we will be in the wilderness for another decade, because reapportionment's coming up next year, everybody knows. And that is why it is so absolutely critical that we win the governor's office. It seems to me we have got to come to the Republicans with a candidate whom the voters of Georgia will believe to be, one, honest, and two, capable of turning around the conditions in this state. If we were to nominate somebody who has been there before and did not do well, there's no reason to believe we would win. I mean, we've got to come with something new. We cannot go back with retreads of old ideas, old policies that have failed us in the past. I've got a solid record of executive accomplishment and political success. I won two statewide races back-to-back in the 90s against serious Republican opposition. So I think I am the Democrat who can win in November, and I think as the race goes along, more of our good, solid Democrats are going to understand that.
Okay, Catherine, do you have any more questions?
I have one more question, and you may not want to answer it, but I think all of us were really puzzled and surprised to see Randall Mangum step up to run for governor. Do you have any idea what the thinking was behind that? Have you had any conversations with anybody about that?
Well, you know, you can hear all kind of speculation out there about why he did it and who else might have been involved in some of those conversations, but you know, I don't have any information about it. People do all kind of strange things in politics, and you know, Randall, he's a friend of mine. I like him, and if he wants to run, that's fine. I think it gives us an interesting lineup. We have three white and three black candidates, and I think, frankly, all six of our candidates are fairly creditable people, and so it's I think our Democratic voters do have a reasonable set of choices. As I mentioned a minute ago, I think I'm the one who is electable, and I think I'm the one that, frankly, that the party ought to pick to be our carry our flag in November.
Well, thank you. I'm done, Tim.
Okay. Keith, do you have any more questions for General Poitras?
I'm done.
Okay, well, as luck would have it, I certainly have another question. and I've asked people in this situation this before, and just to hear the different takes on it. You alluded to the fact that with so many candidates in the race, so many strong candidates, there's going to be a runoff. As a candidate, do you prepare and campaign differently knowing that the end result is going to be a runoff as opposed to, say, running against just one or two other people?
That's an excellent question, Tim, and I don't know that I've consciously thought about that. I think probably the answer is yes. I have a dear friend, Tom Carper, who's a senator from Delaware, and he was the governor there before he became senator. And he said, you know, we have a great tradition in our state. When you run for governor, the two candidates at the end ride in a parade together in the same car. he said that brings a certain level of civility to the campaign, and I think that's probably not a bad idea. But I think certainly on the Democratic side, I think we're going to have a civil, dignified campaign. I don't know about on the other side, and I certainly don't know about the general election. I rather suspect that the general election is going to be pretty tough.
Go ahead, Catherine.
Sorry. Well, this brings up something that's very close to my heart and mind, and that is the idea of instant runoff voting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that are you familiar with the principle behind that, Governor Poitras?
I am, and I'll say I'm familiar with it. I'm certainly not an expert on it, Catherine. I think that has considerable room, you know, study. I think that's a pretty sensible, interesting idea, put it that way.
Well, it would save a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it would also, I think, keep voters more engaged because they would be voting, you know, right now with the runoffs. I mean, we all see the dismal turnout for these runoff elections. It's shameful, really.
It is.
I mean, in the mayor's race in Atlanta, I think Mayor Reed won that by about 35,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible when you think about it.
Exactly. You get
a completely
different turnout dynamic.
The other thing that it does is it kind of adds, it takes some time, I think, but it adds a level of civility to the race because, you know, if you're running and you know that you might not get everyone's first vote, but, you know, you could get their second vote, I think it sort of forces everyone to sort of think about the issue, more about the issues and more about their specific agenda than about the personalities in the other candidates.
I think there's a lot of merit to that. The other thing that I think we need to re-examine is an idea that was actually in Georgia law for about 10 years, and that is we had plurality voting. Not many people remember that, but we had several races earlier in the, I guess back in the 80s, when there would be like an independent candidate or a third group candidate who would draw like 1% or a half of 1%, but it would be enough to throw the race into a runoff. Well, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And so I thought we had what I thought was a very sensible plurality rule, and I forget the exact numbers, but if the highest vote getter was over, I think, 46%, and there was more than a 3-point spread between the number one and the number two person, then the leading person won, even though he didn't have an absolute majority. I think that makes a fair amount of sense, and I would not object to revisiting that idea as far as our election law is concerned.
Well, good. I'm a big fan of it. I think and with these economic times, especially because of the economics of it, I've always liked it because of the sort of opportunity that it gives to second and third tier candidates.
Mm-hmm.
But with economics the way they are and how expensive these elections are,
yeah. Well,
it, And also not just the expense to the state or the municipality that's running the election, but also to the candidates.
Well,
you know, you've got to be thinking, I'm sure you're thinking about that, okay, well, if there's a runoff, I need to have, you know, X number of, you know, X percentage of my funds available for that. So, you know, you're careful about how you spend it. Before that, you know, it becomes a much more complicated scenario.
It does. In addition to that, in addition to the cost, just to the taxpayers as well as to the candidate, is the question of who's doing the voting. As you pointed out, you get a completely different turnout dynamic in a runoff. And sometimes you'll wind up with a very, very small fraction of the electorate making the decision in the runoff, which really raises the question, is this the most democratic way, small d democratic way to run your elections? And I think that's a fair question. So I think to the extent we can figure out ways to either avoid runoffs or otherwise mitigate the impact of them, I think we'll be well served.
Well, when you're governor, we'll talk about that again.
Excellent.
Captain.
I'm done.
General.
Yeah.
I have one more question. Towards the end of the session, the GOP eliminated a income tax cut for low-income Georgians making under $20,000.
Yeah.
But then they turned around and give a tax cut to those making over $150,000 a year.
Right.
Now those that are making under $20,000, they tend to be more senior citizens, low-income Georgians, poor. My question to you is, will that become a major part of your campaign, a major
Absolutely.
Issue for your campaign?
Absolutely.
Because
This administration has got their priorities all wrong, and the two examples you gave are classic. They have given away this state time and time again in tax breaks, in contracts, in various kinds of transactions. They have given away this state to their friends and cronies and put the screws to ordinary working folks who pay the taxes and like you and me. And frankly, that's one of the reasons, Tim, I made that pledge. I think people want a governor that's not going up there to line his own pockets, to pave roads to his friend's farm down in the middle of Georgia, to put sand on his friend's beaches up at Lake Lanier, build fish ponds for his own aggrandizement, give away Jekyll Island. I mean, it's just one thing after another, after another, after another. And you can be absolutely clear, Keith, I'm going to change. And that's really one of the things I can do day one, is change
right.
the image of the governor's office from one of where they are from a ethically and competence, from a standpoint of ethics and competence, this is, to say the least, a challenged administration. I want to project an image of competence and integrity. And that is, in my judgment, we must do that as a bedrock part of our economic development policy. Nobody is going to bring their company to a state where you get that kind of cheating and swindling going on at the highest levels of government. We've got to change that, and I will.
I agree, and you know, and the reasons they did that. One guy said, "Well, these people don't pay income taxes, or they don't deserve a government handout."
Mm.
Now, that $25, $45, $55 that these seniors get, I mean, that goes a long way to paying for doctor visits.
Absolutely.
That's the biggest canard in the you know, people that make less than $20,000 don't pay any taxes.
Of course.
That's ridiculous.
Of course. You think that guy's not going to take his Social Security when he qualifies? You know, you think he's not going to take Medicare when he qualifies? Obviously, they do. I mean, there are lots of government programs that benefit a lot of people. This just happened to be one that benefited some of the least well-off citizens in the state, who are a vulnerable population as far as these people are concerned. I mean, they can put the screws to them and get away with it, and they knew it. And they did it at the, as you pointed out, at the same time, they're voting a $300 million tax cut for the wealthiest Georgians, and at the same time they're laying off teachers and state employees. That I cannot understand it. It is absolutely beyond me. They gave away a $99 million tax cut in 2009 when they were laying off teachers and state employees. And they whine and cry about they can't balance the budget. Well, if you'd mind where you spend your money, it would be a lot easier.
I agree. And you have, I mean, like where I'm in right now, Macon County, it's, you know, we're the second poorest county in the state. Hancock's number one.
Right.
Randolph number three. And, you know, and these counties right here, that decision by the GOP is going to hit the older voters here in these poor areas.
I
call the Black Belt region of Georgia, you know,
right.
From Augusta, Macon, Southwest Georgia, that's going to affect them the most.
Right.
And I don't care what anyone says. They call it a fee increase. I don't care. It's still a tax increase.
Well, of course it is.
Right.
Of course it's a tax increase. They just ain't, you know, gonna call it that. You know. Yeah. They well, this outfit has been guilty of raising taxes all over the place, and they call it a fee increase. But you've seen some of the biggest tax increases under this Republican administration that you have in living memory, I would say.
That's right. That's right. They've raised taxes. And classroom sizes have increased.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers been paid off. People are not getting unemployment checks for a period of time. I mean, it's a mess. And then they go around claiming they're fiscal conservatives. And
all they have to sell, and this was in that memorandum that was circulated around. I mean, hey, you know, most of what they're talking about is fear. It's fear. You know, we're afraid of this, we're afraid of that, we're afraid of the economy, and just fear and hatred, and that's not a policy. That's not a policy. This country was built on optimism and energy and enthusiasm and imagination. That's the kind of governor I'll be. That's the kind of vision I'll bring to the governor's office, and get out of this business of just all they can do is just talk about how much they dislike things and people.
Well, this is always one of my, it's always been one of my, the puzzles to me is these are people who talk forever about how much they hate government, but they sure do work hard to get into it.
Amen.
Absolutely. Well, they talk about, we want little, small government. Well, look at No Child Left Behind, a George W. Bush program. It was the most massive federal invasion into state control of public education in the history of the country. And, you know, so at one time, at one moment, they're talking about, oh, yeah, we want small government, we want to cut government spending, and they create these just overpowering federal programs and run up the national debt out of sight. When Bill Clinton was president, we had a surplus. We had a surplus in the Treasury, and now what they left was the biggest debt in national debt in the history of the country.
Yep.
It's amazing. I mean, they seem to say one thing and do the exact opposite and get away with it. That's the amazing part.
Okay, General, I have one more question before I can let you leave, okay?
I'll stay.
Let's say that someone, one of our listeners, has heard you for the first time tonight. They like what they hear. They would love to get involved in your campaign, make a donation, be a volunteer, do something.
Mm-hmm.
How can they contact you? What can they do? Who can they talk to?
The website has got all the contact information. It's got a staff listing. And the website is poitras4governor.com. It's POYTHRESS, for governor, all spelled out, FOR governor.com.
Well, General, we certainly appreciate you being on with us tonight on the Kudzu Vine, and you be sure to tell Wendy hello for me. She was at our JJ dinner last night. It was great to see her. You got a great campaign manager there, my
friend. Thank you, Tim. I'll see her first thing in the morning, and I'll pass that along.
Okay. Good night, General.
See
Thank
you, guys.
You very
okay.
much.
Bye-bye.
All right, General.
An excellent conversation with one of the fine candidates running for governor of Georgia, General David Poitras, a certain credit to the Democratic Party, and we were really glad to have him on. And now I want to turn back to you, Keith, while we still have time. We don't hear, Catherine and I were talking, we don't hear a lot about legislative races down in your area of the state. And we were just wondering if there are any hot races down there that, say, a party could switch or something like that.
Yes. Let me name a few for you. House District 172 down in Bainbridge, that's Gene Mattis. He's the incumbent. He's got Margene Boyd running for his seat. And Boyd did run for state senate back in 2006, if I'm not mistaken. And she narrowly almost defeated John Buller. She got 47% of the vote. And another one is up in Warner Robins, House District 145. We got Willie Thompson going up against Fanika Miller. She's the chairman of the House and County Democratic Party. And you have one more. Up here in Jim Cole's open seat, House District 125, you got David Galt, who was the former Jones County Commissioner. He's going up against Susan Holmes. She was a former mayor of Monticello, and another young lady, Susan Carter, for that seat. Now, the ones that really got caught my eye is City District 25. That's Johnny Grant's seat. Lloyd Griffin, who was the senator at the time before he left and became mayor of Millersville, he's making a third go-round for that seat. He got a really, really good chance. He has a good chance of taking that seat back for the Democrats. From what I hear up there, voters they're not really happy with Grant leadership, especially in Baldwin County. They have massive job losses. Unemployment is through the roof. Like I said, you got a lot of poor counties in that district. You got Hancock and Greene County, and they want to change up there. And a lot of the business leaders down in Baldwin County kind of push Lloyd Griffin back into that race. So that's the race that I really think that Democrats can flip. One more down in Brunswick, that's Jeff Chapman's old seat, the third district. That's Griffin Lawson. I don't know if you all remember him. He ran for the lieutenant governor in 2006. He's running for that seat down there against Terry Carter and David McGone, if I got that right. Now, there's another seat that can go Democratic. McIntosh County, Glenn County, Doe, and Camden, they got they're trending a little bit Democratic, not that much, but it's an open seat, and you got a lot of Democrats down there working hard trying to turn that area blue. That's a seat right there I will keep my eyes on going into November. And House District 153, that's Austin Scott old seat. John Tibbetts ran for the third time against Tony McBrayer. McBrayer, he is a he's the organizer of the Tiff County Tea Party. John Tibbetts got 47% of the vote last time against Austin Scott. That's another seat that can go Democratic as well. And one more seat that's caught my attention. That's I had on my paper right here. Jay Shaw's 171 House District 176 seat. His son Jason Carter is going to run for that seat. It was believed that he was going to run as an independent, And then in 2012, he was going to switch over to become a Republican, but he decided to run as a Republican for that seat. The Democrat down there is Deborah Tan. She is Secretary of the Lyons County Democratic Party. I reckon call that race down there. It's conservative Democrats, credit area down there. It could go Republican, but the one candidate that would have been perfect with his seat would have been Carr Tamman, but Carr, he's still in the race for governor. Had Carr gotten inside that race, Democrat would have had a real decent chance of retaining that seat. So those are just a few. I wasn't going to name all of them, but House District 153, 172, 125, Senate District 25, Senate District 3. Oh, and I forgot on J.B. Powell, Senate District 23 seat. Bastard Garvin, he dropped out. You go on the Secretary of State website, his name is no longer up there. Chuck Pardue is believed to be the person running in his place. He's going to qualify as an independent and get on the ballot. And I'm assuming that if he goes on to win that seat, that he's going to caucus with the Democrats in the state Senate. So those are a few seats right there that they can really flip over to the Democratic side. But go ahead.
I was going to jump in with a question for you because in my area of the state, there's a nominal Tea Party presence. In the 5th District, I don't think Catherine and her folks even allow those people in the city limits of Atlanta. But we were wondering, down in middle and south rural Georgia, is there a strong Tea Party presence, and could they affect some of the races down there?
Down in the 2nd District, down in Thomas County, Thomasville, they're very strong down there, and they are in real opposition to Sanford Bishop. Now, It will not be enough to unseat Bishop, but, you know, you go from Thomas County, Decatur, Grady, you go around Albany, Lee County, Columbus area. They got Tea Parties there. But the strongest area, if you want to go for a Tea Party, is Thomasville. That's the strongest area. In middle Georgia, there are Tea Parties there, but they're not that strong. They're not that big. It wouldn't be enough to affect any races in this part of the state.
Good.
There was one in Plains, Georgia. That's Jimmy Carter hometown. But, I mean, that thing grew about 12, 13 people down there in Plains. That right there is not going to get it. But Thomasville, that's where it really the strongest, down in Thomas County, Thomasville. That's Mike Kuhn's hometown. And his candidacy is being viewed by the Tea Party. But he will give Bishop a run for his money, but it won't be enough to see Bishop down there. I mean, you know, Southeast Georgia. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, I was going to say you actually answered a question I had, and that was is Congressman Bishop's district safe? And you
right
apparently
now,
believe that it is.
I believe it is. I really believe it is. The only concern I have with Bishop is a lot of his longtime supporters, the farm community, seniors, where all of them abandon his campaign and go with Mike Kuhn, because Mike Kuhn is courting them hard. I mean, he's courting their group hard. The reason why I say Bishop District is safe, if you look at the demographics, it's 47% African American, 49% white. So unless the only way Kuhn can win this district is a huge chunk of the AA African American voters that stay home. But you got Michael Thurman on top of the ticket, and then well, yeah, really, yeah, Michael Thurman is popping the ticket. I really doubt they're going to stay home this midterm election. But they're trying to get him out of there. I mean, they vote for their health care bill. Really got a lot of people upset down here. They protesting at his offices down in Thomasville and Albany, Bainbridge, Columbus. I mean, everything turned around. Somebody hold up a sign saying, Boot Bishop, you know, he got to go. He's too liberal for the second congressional district. It's a lean district. That's what I call it right now. It leans Democratic. Anything can happen. But as of right now, I still say Bishop keep the seat. I think it's 62%, 38% Cune. That's what I say. But it won't be enough. I mean, the Tea Party is strong down in Thomasville, but it's not this strong to actually affect the entire district as a whole. That's my opinion on this race.
Okay. Now, in the last couple of minutes we got here, I wanted to jump over to another state, and because their primary is coming up, and that's the state of Kentucky. We talked before the show came on that a new Research 2000 poll has come out of both the Democratic and the Republican races. And, Catherine, I'm going to turn to you with your take on the Democrats, because all of a sudden it's a three-point race between Lieutenant Governor Mangiardo and Conway, who is the more progressive of the two candidates. Is Conway going to overcome him and beat him?
Boy, I was really surprised when I saw those numbers. But on both sides, they're both like neck and neck, the Republicans and the Democrats. When is that primary? Is it next week?
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's going to be all about turnout. If Conway can, you know, motivate some of those more progressive voters, does he have like Move On and all those guys working with them? If they can get people out to vote or do early voting or whatever their options are, it looks like there's a chance it's like a 12% undecided. So if he can persuade some of those undecideds, then, it's a racehorse, boy. I was really surprised when I saw that, how tight it was on both sides.
And Keith, over on the Republican side, we have watched in amazement as the anti-establishment candidate, I mean, let's face it, Secretary of State Trey Grayson was the establishment pick of the Republicans. Senator McConnell, all kind of people, you know, pushed him forward to run for this. He was anointed for this. All of
right.
a sudden, here comes the son of Ron Paul out of nowhere. He gets the endorsement of Sarah Palin and of the retiring Senator Jim Bunning. He catches fire, and suddenly, in the last month, we have seen nothing but double-digit leads. Is Dr. Paul, and the Tea Party, I might add, is all for Dr. Paul. Is he going to pull this thing off?
Yes. He got it. I mean, when you get Sarah Palin's endorsement, that's a lock. I mean, she's
mm-hmm.
the darling of the base. She's the darling. And, you know, and that's why I call it. It's a lock. I mean, he's got, 45% to Trey Grayson, 35%. I mean, and then the primary is on Tuesday. He got wrapped up in the bag. I mean, he got that race. If I'm one of the Democrats running for the Senate, I would hope that he becomes the nominee, because that's what I think they have their best chance of winning that Senate seat if he's the nominee. If I wanted Democrats, I would have Rand Paul. I mean, he got Sarah Palin, then he got Jim Bunning, and there've been reports that he's had some critical things to say about Mitch McConnell. So I'm wondering, if he were to win that Senate seat, how will those two cooperate with each other? That's what I'm wondering. But he's got in the bag. I mean, he got a double-digit lead right now. I mean, unless something catastrophic happens between now and Tuesday, I mean, he will be the nominee for the GOP up there in Kentucky.
And with that,
Yeah, we got.
And with that,
20 seconds.
I'm going to have to say that we have reached the end of another Kudzu Vine. Boy, the hour passed in a hurry. Keith, I want to thank you for sitting in tonight for David. You are so knowledgeable in, especially in Middle and South Georgia politics, and that's a knowledge that I'll be glad to tell you I lack. You are welcome. You are welcome anytime to come join us on the Kudzu Vine. I'll personally kick David off the air to put you on. but seriously, Keith, thank you for being with us tonight. Our door is open always to you, sir.
Thank you a lot.
And to Catherine, we will see you next week.
Yep. Good night, guys.
Good night, folks.
All right.